I'd like to welcome everyone to the Weber Teleclass and thanks our sponsor for today's presentation, which is Virox Canada. It gives me great pleasure to introduce my friend and fellow traveler, Russell Olmsted, who will be presenting today. Russell and I most recently were together in England, in Liverpool, at the Infection Prevention Society's conference that was held earlier this October. I was much more of an observer. Russell was actually presenting at it, and it was nice to see him again. Just a little background on Russell Olmsted. Russell has over 29 years of experience in the fields of infection prevention and control and healthcare epidemiology. His education background includes a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Michigan and a master's of public health in general epidemiology from the University of Michigan School of Public Health in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He also holds board certification in infection prevention and control from the Certification Board of Infection Control and Epidemiology, Inc., or CIVIC, as we all know of it. He is currently the director of Infection Prevention and Control Services at St. Joseph's Mercy Health System, headquartered in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he is an associate editor of the American Journal of Infection Control. He was the 2011 president of APIC and is currently the 2012 chair of APIC's Practice Guidance Committee. Russell's talk today is called Critique and Use of the Scientific Evidence, Sharpening Skills, and I'll turn it over to you, Russ.
Great. Thank you, Jim, and welcome everybody to another Weber training session. Would also like to thank Jim for moderating today's session and also Weber training for having me provide a faculty for this particular session. And thank you all for dialing in to, I'm sure, a busy day no matter where you are throughout the globe. So I'll try to keep a little bit of global perspective on this one in terms of giving you some taste of some activities that your colleagues are doing around the world. And then also talk a little bit about really the, I think setting this particular session up is that my perspective is that infection preventionists are first and foremost consumers of the scientific literature. Many of us certainly are doing some research and getting that published, which is great, but I would say the majority of us are not running randomized controlled trials with a multi-center intervention, but really are benefiting from the investigation provided by our colleagues that are looking at some of these studies and interventions, looking at improving, I think, quality and safety of patient care. So why don't we get started here? If you're following along, I'm on, going to skip to slide number 2 here, talking about some disclosures for me personally are listed there on the page. Just wanted to give you a sense of those and make sure everybody's aware for faculty what activities we're involved with in terms of extracurricular activities. Those are listed there on slide number 2. So for today's agenda, I'm on slide number 3. Really going to focus on identifying at least one search engine that is readily accessible no matter where you are. Also going to talk about ways to score the quality and strength of these peer review studies. So there's some wonderful systems out there that are readily available, and going to highlight one in particular that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee is using going forward with creating new guidelines. So they're using this type of methodology to score the quality and strength of the studies. And once they've scored those, they're wording the recommendations that are supported by those investigations accordingly with those, both the strength and the quality of the investigations. And then talk about a little bit of application in terms of use of this data or the evidence as published, and really focusing on ultimately what we're going to use this evidence for is to prevent infection. So that's kind of our game plan for this particular session on Weber training. So slide number 4, entitled Building the Case for a Connection Between Scientific Evidence and the Infection Preventionist. I did think it was worthwhile because you may ask, why do we worry about locating this evidence and what do we need it for? But I think there's some good documents that at least point to these particular kind of underlying professional practice resources that really do speak to this directly. So one of those is the APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, and the CHICA Canada have both endorsed and actually published this professional and practice standards back in 2008. In the American Journal of Infection Control. And one of the elements within this is entitled research, and you can see there it actually calls for infection preventionists to participate, evaluate, and or apply relevant research findings to infection prevention, control, and epidemiology, and then also speaks directly to what we're talking about today, critically evaluates published research and incorporates appropriate findings. So clearly we have some good basis here in this particular document that's been out for quite some time. So that's one good place to point to why we need to kind of answering the question as to why are we worried about research and scientific evidence. Slide number 5, moving on. Again, continuing this building this case for the connection here is a couple of new resources that are currently available. And these are both, Jim mentioned that we were fortunate to both be in Liverpool at the Infection Prevention Society conference earlier in October 2012. And one thing I would like to highlight is the IPS has actually published a very nice competency review for infection preventionists. In other words, what are the key skills and knowledge that we should have as infection preventionists? And this is entitled Outcome Competencies for Practitioners in Infection Prevention and Control. Lead author is Burnett, and then was also accompanied by the Competency Steering Work Group convened by the IPS. A wonderful document. Has lots of information, but these two caught my eye when I went through those. One of the domains that they call out is research, as you can see there, and clearly right on the mark. For preventionists, we want you to be able to access, appraise, and then apply the evidence that you identify that's been published in the peer review literature, and then use that to share best practices that you found, kind of local wisdom, I guess, as it were, that many times there are studies published in the literature. I think it's the application of that that's as, if not more, interesting, because many of us have novel ways to approach problems and have found something that works quite well. So that clearly goes within that. And then education for ourselves, certainly learning to do critical analysis and evaluation of the published literature and peer-reviewed research studies. So again, another resource that really points to the need for us to be really improve those skills or sharpen those skills, as it were, involving both the identification of scientific literature, but then also the application thereof. And then more recently, on slide number 6, another competency paper that APIC has published earlier this year. It's entitled Competency and Infection Prevention, a Conceptual Approach to Guide Current and Future Practice, and the lead author is Denise Murphy. And that was published in May in the American Journal of Infection Control. And again, one of the key domains within that relates to infection prevention and control practice. And a sub-element of that is the infection preventionist must be able to critically evaluate research and apply the findings to their practice setting. And then also a kind of a newer term that's been introduced, but performance improvement we're familiar with, but the phrase implementation science, I like that because it really captures, I think, in a short, very concise manner, describing what most of us do in infection prevention is we're really each day looking out for the safety and improving the quality of care of our patients, but also applying those lessons learned in the literature to the patients that we serve and improving that their outcome in terms of their healthcare delivery process. So this calls, when we talk about implementation science, some sub-elements of that include reviewing the literature as kind of an essential skill tool and very important for us to hold. And then we have to interpret and then apply various systematic reviews, including meta-analyses, and apply those really to the patient care that we are taking care of. Some important things when we critique that literature is we can recognize some limitations of the study as well as biases that may be present in the investigation. So some of those things are very helpful. And I know Chica Canada also wanted to recognize Jim as the current president, I believe. I think I've got that right, Jim. And you've developed a self-assessment tool that also is available for preventionists to really, and I'm sure that speaks to kind of identifying research findings in the literature as well. So a lot of good resources, I think, currently available for us to review and use as a basis really to going forward in terms of improving patient care and patient safety. We're really strongly encouraging infection preventionists to pursue certification in infection prevention and control from CIBIC. So obtaining that and then moving through various levels of your career where it goes from basically novice through proficient and then expert. So those are, as you move out towards the periphery of the circle here, you're getting more advanced or more experienced and developing skills and even more higher level, depending on the various areas. We certainly don't expect this to be, you know, everybody who's got a number of years experience will be automatically in all these domains at that peripheral edge of the circle, but clearly gives you a spectrum depending on the different domains. So kind of moving your practice forward and your professional development forward. These are some key things to be aware of. Slide number 8, just for those of you that have facilities or affiliates that are accredited by the Joint Commission. Again, Joint Commission is not necessarily solely limited to North America, but there are many through Joint Commission International are opting to get accreditation. But many of these national patient safety goals, which are part of the accreditation process, in other words, these are expectations of facilities that are accredited by the Joint Commission would adhere to these principles. But one of the national patient safety goals, 7.03.01, is implement evidence-based practices to prevent healthcare-associated infections due to multidrug-resistant organisms in acute care hospitals. So clearly, when you look at the highlighted text there in terms of evidence-based practices, that again points to the fact that the infection preventionist needs to be able to identify that evidence and then assess it, how good of a signal are we getting out of that research investigation, and then apply that appropriately. Another brand new national patient safety goal is the focused on prevention of catheter-associated urinary tract infections, and I've just given you some sense at least of the kind of the requirements. These are elements of performance that Joint Commission has called out related to prevention of urinary catheters. And then the strength of the evidence is used, one of the scoring schemes they use is looking at how good of a signal or how rigorous is the scientific evidence under each of these elements in terms of that's readily available to us. So some good support, I think, in a broad perspective, not only for our own development, but also external entities are really expecting infection preventionists to use the scientific literature, and very pleased to be able to talk about this topic today. I think it's one of the key skills for us going forward. So slide number 9, finding the evidence. I think that's one of the big challenges, and did want to highlight at least one resource that I think is essential for everybody and readily available is the PubMed is the particular format that we use. It's really based on the National Library of Medicine here in the U.S., kind of a bibliographic search system, and it's built off of Medline, which has been in existence for quite some time, but they developed this front piece engine that really makes it fairly simple to locate this particular evidence and search literature. So the internet site's provided there. As you can see, I mentioned some of the half the battle potentially, or even if not more so, is to locate this evidence, and you can see why that's not necessarily easy. There's over almost 22 million records in from well over almost 6,000 different journals or publications that are contained within this database. And the beauty is that for new studies that get published, there's somebody within National Library of Medicine that's categorizing some of the key elements within these studies, usually particularly from the abstract, classifying those into medical subject headings. And that's what really allows you the ability to search through this literature and find the study that you're particularly interested in. So just a few kind of caveats in terms of these mesh headings. Again, they're primarily originally developed by folks that are experts in health informatics, and so they're looking at terminology that's pretty universal. So the term that we used to certainly cozy up to a lot is the phrase nosocomial, or the word nosocomial. That actually maps to the objective term cross-infection. So if you type in nosocomial, it'll still find studies that relate to that, but that's really the more precise phrase is actually cross-infection if you're going to do a search. You can do that. The beauty of this PubMed kind of search engine is all you need to do is put a string of terms in there. You don't even have to put adjectives or connectors, and it'll begin to search for a variety of things that you're interested in. So slide number 10 here in terms of what's available at the very top of the slide is kind of a screenshot of what the search window looks like. So at the very top there, usually in the upper, in that kind of open area in the middle of the search window, you can type in your term. Simply hit the click the phrase or the search button there, and you'll locate any number of studies that relate to that particular term or terms that you insert into that search window. So the steps are listed there. Again, very simple way to do this. You can do a much more complex search if you want. The nice thing I think about PubMed is there's a very extensive tutorial that you can walk through. They actually have some YouTube video clips to show you how somebody walks through the search itself. So you can become quite proficient even without a formal training class, I think, in this particular tool. And that's why I particularly like this. Also the fact that it's readily available 24/7, 365 days a year, and there's absolutely no charge to use this. So you don't have to be a subscriber or, happen to be connected to a medical library, which is great, but this one's really readily available no matter where you are. You can really take a look at the literature from home, work, or anywhere in between. So I think very, very useful resource here. Just an example for you to test and kind of trial this either during this session or thereafter. Just put in the terms in that search window, cross-infection, Clostridium difficile, and you'll see a number of studies that'll pop up. In fact, when I ran this the other day, found over 1,200 studies that popped in. So abstracts are really kind of a summary of the research or the investigator's findings, and they're usually in often a structured abstract, which gives you kind of the introduction or background. There'll typically be a section within that abstract that talks about methods, so it gives you an idea of how the study was run, the results, and then finally conclusions or discussion will be the kind of the other component of that one. So quick way to kind of scan the key findings from the study, and then you can delve into that more, obtain full text if it's available for it to you. The other advantage of PubMed is many of the publishers will actually provide full text of the study online. Now again, it's going to vary depending on the publisher or the author, but those are readily available as well. So you can not only do the search, but you can pull up the whole study as you go forward. Slide number 11, this is a screenshot of that same search. You can see there in the window, kind of the upper third of the screen, there's the phrase cross-infection Clostridium difficile. I put that in there. And the first study that shows up there is recent changes in Clostridium difficile infection. And this is by the lead author is Sylvia, first name Junior, and middle initial M from Sao Paulo. And that actually, the full text, you can see their free article is readily available. There's some other things. There's a lot of information here, as you can see on PubMed. But over just to the right of that first study, you can see a graph that tells you how many studies are published with this particular search term put together. So you can see we've had a significant growth in the number of studies on this particular topic. I mentioned full text available. If you look down there on the lower right side of the kind of the right-hand bottom of this particular screenshot, 144 free full-text articles are readily available. Again, click of a button, you can pull all those up if you want and read to your heart's content. So a lot of good information, I think, readily available from this resource, and would encourage everybody to at least kick the tires on PubMed and even type a simple question that you might have into that search window and give it a go, so see how it goes for you. Slide 12, just a few other things. There, I mentioned the advanced search capabilities, so there is a tutorial that accompanies that, which I think is quite helpful to get oriented to PubMed. Some abstracts as well that you can look at, and also email those abstracts when you find them. You could email that to a colleague or to yourself. Add those to a clipboard, which actually saves your search that you did, say, a few hours ago, and you can also export those citations to, let's say, there's some citation management softwares like EndNote that actually puts those into a format that you can use for creating a manuscript as well. So lots of tools here, I think, that are readily available to you. As I mentioned already, full text articles, depending on what the publisher's provided, and then some other nice functionality for this includes if you find an abstract that looks particularly interested to your particular search, Over on the right side, there's a little highlighted hypertext link that says related citations. So all of the mesh terms that are part of that abstract are then captured in a broader search, and it'll pull up all of the studies that match those particular mesh terms. So you can actually expand your search from that. So some fairly easy things to do even without knowing all of the mesh headings, and at least get to the looking at some studies that are pretty good, pretty much relevant to your particular interest. LinkOut takes you to some other resources that are available via PubMed, and then Clinical Queries is another tool within National Library of Medicine where you can actually bring up a disease topic and look into some information that's available. So I think that, to me, has been a great tool and very useful, I think, for us as infection preventionists to try to locate this evidence. Slide 13, just wanted to share that there are certainly other engines that are even more sophisticated but also well-developed tools for searching the literature, and this includes other databases such as the Cumulative Index to Nursing and Allied Health Literature, or CINAHL, and that's hosted by one of the publishers here. EBSCO actually has their own search engine that they've developed, and they actually have a number of different publications, so those links are provided there. Ovid is another. It's a product of Wolters Kluwer Publishing, and that also is a very nice search engine. Many of these are provided if you're affiliated with an academic institution or have some tie to that. The medical library in many of those facilities has these available for you online, so it certainly is, again, another avenue that's present and available to you. I would also encourage you, if you've got a academic center somewhere in your region, I can guarantee you there's a group of medical librarians or informaticists that are readily available, willing and able to kind of teach you the finer points of literature searches. So would encourage you to connect with those individuals, those professionals, and learn more about searching the scientific literature. So there's nothing wrong with picking up the phone or connecting via an email, and I think there's a wealth of resources. Those professionals have lots of skill in locating this particular evidence that you may be interested in. Slide 14, and we're kind of move into looking at the critique of the literature, and I think this is a nice image here in terms of the what I call the hierarchy of evidence in terms of strength and quality of the findings. So you can see there that expert opinion, while it's at the bottom of the triangle, probably is the least strongest in terms, or the quality of the findings are going to be probably lowest for folks that are, quote, experts in a particular field. And the reason is that really reflects their opinion or their experience. Same thing with an editorial is certainly somebody's perspective on things, but doesn't necessarily mean it's scientifically rigorous and been tested and validated and reproducible. So as you move up that pyramid, we get to case series or case reports are certainly interesting. Again, it may be an artifact of that particular investigator's experience. Maybe people came to that individual just because of their reputation, and they see, you know, the very unusual cases or the kind of atypical presentation, and so their conclusions may be quite a bit different than other folks in terms of, you know, ways to treat a particular disease or a particular intervention. So that may bias them a little bit. So take that with a grain of salt. Some more classic epidemiologic approaches include case-control studies or cohort studies. Those are certainly useful data, but they are also inherently have some of their own challenges in terms of biases that the investigators may apply. As you move up this, randomized control trials certainly are getting much more rigorous because we have an ability to really randomize the intervention and see does it really have an impact on the patient population studied or the intervention being used. And then systematic reviews are really detailed analyses and putting those into a summary and analytical approach, often referred to as meta-analysis, where you combine investigations or results from a number of studies, again, applying some fairly rigorous sorting tools to the evidence that's presented by the authors, and then that comes up with some even broader conclusions. Probably the prototype for that has been the Cochrane collaboration out of the UK originally, as a really a global network of folks that do systematic reviews of published literature, and will give you, you as the consumer, a sense of, you know, how strong is this For example, use of chlorhexidine gluconate to prepare the skin prior to insertion of an intravascular catheter. What is the strength of that evidence as we look at the number of studies that have been published to date? So there is clearly a hierarchy. I think that's important to be aware of. And the other piece that this doesn't capture per se is there's a lot of literature that's not necessarily peer-reviewed. And again, a true peer-reviewed publication is going to really identify that they are peer-reviewed and also disclose quite clearly that they do a very rigorous process in terms of sending out a manuscript to, you know, maybe one to two authors or two other folks in the field that have expertise on this topic. They review the manuscript and then let the editor know, you know, this should go forth or move forward in terms of publication, or, you know, ask many times for you and I who are getting studies published, many times we're asked to revise and then resubmit on our investigation. So that gives you some benefit of having some different eyes on that particular study. Slide 15, evidence-based practice. Again, some stepwise approach here. Dr. Sackett and others put together a nice review of evidence-based practice. We use that term a lot, I think, in our field, and has a nice definition there of the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of current best evidence in making decisions about the care of the individual patient. It means integrating individual clinical expertise with the best available external clinical evidence from systematic research. So a nice definition, I think, that really highlights that. Again, this is focused on clinical care, but we can use this as an evidence-based approach to infection prevention practices. And really, I think the steps here on the right side of the slide outline the way this is formulated. So you're kind of presented with a particular problem as the infection preventionist. How do you approach that? And one of the ways to look at this is really develop a question that you need an answer for, or a problem that's presented itself, I think, is the best way to start. Locate this evidence. So we want to search the literature and see what others have looked and found as effective. And many times this is extremely helpful, because when you think you've got, you're the only one who's encountered this problem, probably 9 times out of 10, I find during the search of literature that somebody else has begun to look at this or an aspect of our particular problem and actually come up with some ideas on how to take a look at that and study ways to improve that problem or prevent that cross-transmission, for example. We appraise that evidence, kind of the next step, and then apply this to maybe our particular population we take care of, and then certainly evaluate, you know, did it work for our patient population as well, and ultimately share that with other infection preventionists is kind of the way we really move the practice forward. So just some of the key steps there. Slide 16, so sharpening those skills. We already talked quite a bit about PubMed. This is a screenshot again of the homepage for PubMed. Formulate your question, go to this particular search engine, and you can see, hopefully we can sift through all of the manuscripts that are there, but pretty astounding amount of information when you look at the number of manuscripts published each year is probably at least 800,000 and probably growing each year as well. So a lot of information out there that our colleagues are finding and sharing. The challenge there is just locating that, and many times this tool can really help you narrow down that search and get to the answer that you're looking for. Slide 17, just wanted to highlight, I mentioned earlier about HICPAC, the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee. The chairman at the time was P.J. Brennan, introduced this approach, and I think very logical one, since we're all trying to apply evidence-based practices. This is really the kind of the hierarchy that we're using now. So this methodology was begun with the catheter-associated UTI prevention guideline, which got published, that was developed in 2009, got published in on CDC's website in 2009 as well, so that's readily available to you, the full guideline. A companion piece, Craig Umscheid and others are affiliated with an evidence-based practice center in Pennsylvania, and they developed or really kind of explained the new methodology in a very extensive review, and that's in American Journal of Infection Control in 2010, so you can see that there in the middle of the page. And that really did With HCPAC, they are formulating key questions of an interest to infection preventionists and then going through a very systematic review of the literature. And their scheming or their kind of way to score these studies and develop recommendations from that is really based on the GRADE system, which stands for Grading of Recommendations, Assessment, Development, and Evaluation. And that the original citation that the group that are using this GRADE methodology is included in this particular paper by Dr. Umscheid and others. But you can see the various steps that are employed for all of the new HCPAC guidelines or the revisions really is starting out with a search, a guideline search of, you know, existing guidelines, the status of those, developing some key questions out of those particular guidelines, then doing literature search. The folks that are kind of doing the heavy lifting and looking at this literature, looking at the abstracts, and then pulling full text of those studies that are included based on their inclusion criteria. They're extracting data out of those particular studies, and from that, the wording of the recommendations are developed for HCPAC, and then HCPAC kind of reviews those and finalizes those recommendations. So fairly good stepwise approach, I think, at least in my experience, has been very positive move for HCPAC to go to more an evidence-based approach. So the GRADE system on slide 18 here gives you an idea of some ways to look at the literature. This is, again, you can go to Craig's review here and pull up the study and get a lot more detail about applying the GRADE system. But you can see the type of evidence on the far left in table one there. So randomized controlled trials get an initial grade of fairly high level because it is a randomized controlled trial. There are criteria listed to both give an additional point or take a point away, depending on what you find in the study. And that includes both looking at the quality of the particular investigation, the important or whether there's any inconsistencies within the findings in the particular publication. Does it directly apply to the problem that the investigators purport in terms of the title? How precise is the analysis? And then is there any publication bias? So all those things kind of go into, there's an objective criteria for each of these. So you get a additional score, yes, or you could get some points subtracted. And then finally, end up with an overall quality grade. So depending on your investigation, you may have some observational studies that do pretty well. Randomized control trials, if they've been done correctly and the methodology's good and solid, then in general, those are going to be usually higher quality evidence using that criteria that we talked about earlier. And then formulating recommendations, you can see these are the current methodology that HCPAC's applying. So a strong category one looks at the interventions and whether the studies show a net benefit or a harm, and then you're given category 1A, 1B, and 1C are kind of the three levels in that one. You may have a category 2, which means the evidence is not as strong, showing one direction or another. And unfortunately, too often, we also find there are no studies that address a particular question or a problem, and so those get no recommendation. Kind of an unresolved issue is the way that these recommendations are categorized. So, some useful way to look at the evidence, and always important when you're looking at a guideline such as those issued by, let's say, HCPAC or guidelines from other international organizations in the UK. There's the EPIC guidelines, which were developed by a lot of the members within IPS, the Infection Prevention Society there, and developed some key recommendations. All those also have scores in terms of the strength and quality of the finding, but also the citations on which those recommendations are built. So those are all important pieces to examine when you're looking at these particular guidelines and the recommendations that come from those. So application of this, slide 19, when we apply this grade system or this ranking scheme, I just thought this would be timely. Certainly, Jim and I share a significant interest in enteropathogens, and norovirus is one of those that keeps, I think, many of us up at night, and certainly a challenging pathogen. And there is a guideline that HCPAC published last year on the prevention control of norovirus gastroenteritis outbreaks in healthcare facilities. So That's readily available from CDC's website. And what I did was pull one of the questions out of that guideline so you can see how this was developed. So the key question is, what are the best methods to identify an outbreak of norovirus gastroenteritis in a healthcare setting? And the literature search actually found pretty good quality evidence from, interestingly, one particular study developed by Dr. Kaplan and others to look at outbreaks. At that time, this was predated the discovery of norovirus, but clearly the clinical symptoms were fairly dramatic. If you've encountered norovirus, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So the diagnostic criteria are do not require laboratory, you know, electron micrograph evidence that it's norovirus, but these work quite well in terms of the pattern of illness that presents when this particular pathogen's in play. So their recommendation they developed from looking at this evidence was, in the absence of clinical laboratory diagnostics, or in the case of delay in obtaining laboratory results, use Kaplan's clinical and epidemiologic criteria to identify a norovirus gastroenteritis outbreak, and that's a Category 1A level recommendation. So some pretty good evidence even from a single study in this, and was reevaluated and confirmed by Turcos and others back in 2006 in clinical infectious disease. But to Dr. Kaplan's credit, he developed this back in 1982, actually, was when this study originally got published in the American Journal of Public Health. So key, another aspect of this particular slide is always, I would strongly encourage you to go to the primary evidence. HCPCS doesn't always 100% of the time get it completely right and is completely error-free. So a lot of guidelines, when you go to the original study on which the recommendation was developed, may or may not say exactly what it would imply when you look at the recommendation. So it's important to go to those primary references where you're looking at what, you know, how did the committee or the group that developed this recommendation develop that, and really look at the primary evidence that's in the peer-reviewed literature. So would encourage you to be part of your careful consumerism is to really dig into that original study, pull that full text up, and make sure it says what it seems to say based on the recommendation. In the past, that's not always been 100% accurate in terms of those two things, so that's an important thing to be aware of. Great. So slide 20, how good is the quality and quantity of evidence? So this was, again, another offshoot, I think, of Dr. Umscheid and others looked at the, you know, what proportion of healthcare-associated infections are preventable. And this was quite interesting. I think this highlights a couple of the points I made earlier, that you can see they did a literature search, potentially found well over 4,800 studies that matched the search criteria. When they narrowed that focus, they ended up with about 434 articles that they actually pulled that looked closer to the mark. Of those 434, only 64 met their inclusion criteria. And from that 64, actually only 15 ended up in the final analysis for this particular investigation, looking again at what proportion of studies could we, or what proportion of infections can we ultimately prevent? Can we eliminate them and make that 100%, or do we have somewhere in between 0 and 100%? So when you apply kind of those filtering criteria, you can see the reasons that using the grade system, a lot of these studies were low quality, so they were immediately eliminated using that grade classification system. Some of them were older than 10 years, so not as confident about the applicability of that information to the current time. Some of the studies or the investigations only reported processes, so they had no outcome data. And then this one, in terms of the criteria for this particular investigation, they were excluding studies performed outside the U.S. Now, again, if you're in Europe or somewhere Southeast Asia, you may include those studies more closer to home, so those are going to depend on the group putting together this particular analysis. But so the conclusions, what proportion are preventable? This is your first class assignment for Weber training today, is put the search terms listed below there on the bottom of this particular slide. So Umscheid, CA is Craig, is his first name, middle initial is A, and then cost, COST, cross infection, and then the year 2011, and that should get you to the right location to locate this particular study and see what the author has concluded on that one. So I'm going to leave you hanging with that particular assignment and have you go about doing that. Slide 21, moving on, resource on review and assessment of the evidence. Very nice review by Elizabeth Sakluna, who published this in another journal. This one is readily available to you as well. The International Federation for Infection Control of Infection Control actually has their own journal. And she did a very good review, I thought, of kind of looking at the evidence, identifying some of those things that may lessen the quality and strength or improve the quality and strength of the study. So some things that are listed in this nice review, and she also discusses the use of the meta-analysis as well. So would encourage you to locate this, even if you search in Google, put in the search term IFIC, or International Federation of Infection Control, you'll come to their homepage, and then the journal is available through that particular website. Again, that's full text is readily available. You don't have to necessarily be an IFIC member or actively involved in the Federation, although we'd certainly encourage you to do so, but that is available for you as well through the internet. So some good resources, I think, available to you out there. So slide 22, are we using the evidence is one of the good questions for infection preventionists. So how are we doing to date? Slide 23, just wanted to highlight, even if you have the best ideas and some advice, are your colleagues automatically doing that? And you know the history of some advices. He had fairly rigorous scientific evidence that showed hand hygiene was important in improving patient safety. Having some challenges in kind of, in I guess, convincing his colleagues that indeed hand hygiene before doing delivery of newborns was very important. And unfortunately, he got very frustrated. But there is clearly, even if you have a great idea, a real innovation, Dr. Rogers put this together back in 1962, actually looking at the diffusion of innovation, and it unfortunately takes exceedingly a long period of time. So you can see that you may be able to convince a few friends and colleagues fairly early on. There may be some other folks that learn of your new intervention and adopt that fairly early. And then there's quite a lag phase, as you can see here. The early majority pragmatists are, you know, really want to be skeptically review that study and critique it and see, you know, are you really convincing me? And then late majority conservatives, and then finally the laggards and skeptics still can't be convinced until overwhelming amount of evidence. So my question here for you to think about is, Semmelweis showed a fairly quick way to do hand hygiene work quite well. And in the U.S., it took us quite some time to get alcohol-based hand rubs. Actually, the year was about 2002 before that was adopted into the CDC HCPCS hand hygiene guidelines. So just to give you a sense of some of the time frames there, there's some fascinating history about use of lemon juice for sailors back in early maritimes, and I would encourage you to look at that evidence as well. But that took quite some time to get adopted so that sailors weren't falling because of experiencing fatal trips on the seas because of lack of vitamin C. So there's some interesting history there. It took quite some time actually to get that adopted as well throughout the maritime industry. So slide 24, bringing it up to a little bit more closer to real time. This is some interesting surveys that have been done by Dr. Krein and others looking at adoption of prevention strategies aimed at preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection. So these are studies within the U.S. looking at a fairly significant, about 700 hospitals across the U.S., and a 100% sample of all Veteran Affairs medical centers as well. So a couple of groups that were included in this, but you can see 2005, in terms of bladder ultrasound, this is looking at what's the level of post-void residual in patients using a bladder ultrasound so that we can even avoid having to use indwelling urinary catheters. And that was about 29% back in 2005. In 2009, that sneaked up a little bit to 39%, but again, not overwhelmingly high. There's some sub-analysis of infection preventionists here just in the state of Michigan, and that's what you can see there is the 2005-2009. So in Michigan, a little bit higher level of adoption of this bladder ultrasound technology, about 57% by 2009. The second group there, reminder stop orders. These are techniques to really make sure people are aware that indwelling urinary catheters are in use. And you can see even in 2009 nationwide sample, only about 20% of facilities actually had some type of reminder or a stop order for indwelling urinary catheters. The stop order would be kind of, if you have an electronic medical record, it would pop up with a reminder to the provider that, hey, this patient has, Mr. Jones has a urinary catheter in place. Does this patient still need the catheter? And so it's another technology solution or potentially a sticker on the chart that can remind providers that those are in place. Antimicrobial urinary catheters, another group that some practices were looked at. By 2009, about 45% of those surveyed indicated they were using those devices. In Michigan, a little bit less than that. You can see only about 13%, and no real change between 2005 and 2009. And then for male patients, condom catheters still, despite one actually study that's been quite well done with males in terms of using condom catheters, still overall only about 10% of hospitals are using that particular technology to avoid indwelling devices. So not necessarily rapid. We're kind of somewhere in that diffusion of innovation curve in terms of some of our prevention practices, and some of the evidence just may not be there. Slide 25, looking at the efficacy of enhancing catheter awareness. This is an example of a meta-analysis done by Dr. Mettings and others looking at various interventions. And you can see there are about five studies looking at reminder systems that the urinary catheter is in place. That diamond there at the bottom of that, or kind of the middle of the page, indicates that all those studies were summarized and their results kind of collapsed into one overall analysis. And you can see about if you have a reminder system, you can reduce the risk of catheter-associated UTI in your population by probably almost half in terms of its efficacy. Stop orders also about the same when you look at these particular studies in terms of their efficacy and the interventions that the authors presented. So this is a useful technique, I think, overall in terms of ways to improve or prevent catheter-associated UTIs, just making sure people are aware that those devices are in place. So slide 26 has your second class assignment today. Is there anything, any new evidence on efficacy of antimicrobial urinary catheters? So I'm encouraging you all to use PubMed to really identify this particular investigation. So you've got the steps outlined there. Type in that phrase, antimicrobial urinary catheters 2012, and see what you find out. Again, no excuses if your dog does happen to eat your internet browser on this particular one, but would encourage you to try this out, use PubMed, and kick the tires a bit, as it were, on that particular system. Slide 27, implementation science, just a definition there. I mentioned that early as part of the APIC new competency model, and I think this captures nicely what we as infection preventionists do. So it is the scientific study of methods to promote the systematic uptake of clinical research findings and other evidence-based practices into routine practice, and hence improve the quality, effectiveness, reliability, safety, appropriateness, equity, and efficiency of healthcare. It includes the study of influences on healthcare professional and organizational behavior. That latter phrase, I think, is important because we have lots of great products, for example, for hand hygiene. We still, I think, to this day, even though Dr. Semmelweis would ask us to, you know, how are we doing now, we still have some challenges getting that hand hygiene done, you know, 100% of the time, the five moments of hand hygiene that we want all of our providers to use still is a challenge, I think, and it's not so much the product, but it really is the behavior and the use of that particular practice that we continually have to focus on, but also improve with our colleagues. So slide 28, again, reinforcing that the implementation science piece is a significant portion of the, or one of the key domains of the APIC competency model. So I would encourage you to take a look at that paper as well as the other ones by Barnett as well from the Infection Prevention Society. Some great resources there looking at our competency. If you look at that competency model, here's the three levels within that. So novice, proficient, and advanced. just give you some ideas, at least in terms of how you would progress in through this, looking particularly at use of evidence and scientific evidence across this career development of the infection preventionist. So I thought this was a useful table just for you to get a taste of how one moves from fairly new in the field to one who's got fairly significant amount of experience and has sharpened these skills significantly. Slide 30, so moving evidence from the journals to the bedside. Just wanted to highlight for those who have achieved certification in infection prevention and control, some good evidence here showing that indeed you're accelerating or getting evidence from the journals to the patient population you serve. And these are four studies that show a correlation between implementation of evidence-based practices and the level of training or competence, per se, of the infection preventionist. So some good evidence to take a look at. These are studies really looking at correlations between practices and the skill set of the infection preventionist. Just wanted to highlight another term that you may have heard, translational research, also is similar to implementation science, and it's a little bit more systematic classification of the approach on this one, but really looks at moving knowledge and discovery from basic and epidemiologic sciences to the application in both clinical and community settings. Slide 32, there's different levels for translational research. So we may have kind of initial investigations at T0. These are new discoveries, maybe laboratory-based evidence or surveillance findings from outbreak investigations, those types of things. And then as you move deeper down this list, you're seeing wider adoption based on the interventions that have been published by the authors in this particular evidence. So you can go from T0 all the way through T4 as kind of evaluate the real-world health outcomes of population health practices. So quite a range here in terms of the level of evidence from translational research. Slide 33, you can see this is really just a model to illustrate this, moving up the pyramid again to looking at real-world outcomes. And there's various tiers kind of from basic research all the way to fairly widespread adoption of a particular intervention. As you can see, sometimes we have delays and moving the evidence, and even in CDC HCPCS guidelines for prevention of IV-associated infection, the 2011 guidelines that were published in American Journal of Infection Control, also available on CDC website, did talk about the proper antisepsis for the skin for patients prior to insertion of vascular catheters, but that took quite some time. 1991 was one of the landmark studies that some colleagues in the field of infection prevention published, and it took quite some time before that was adopted into guideline evidence, even though there was pretty good rigor around that original study. So some good awareness, at least, as to kind of, again, that lag phase of adoption. Slide 34, Denise Cardo and others at CDC did call for elimination of healthcare-associated infections, and I think these are some good pillars, at least, to shoot for in terms of how we're going to get there. At least is a good goal. Whether we'll realize that is certainly a debate ongoing when we talk to a lot of infection preventionists. But this particular quote, I think, really highlights, again, looking at the scientific evidence as our foundation for really moving practice forward. And that's why, again, it's important to be good consumers and critically appraise the scientific evidence. Slide 35, just an illustration of some of the application of this evidence. This is very good work out of Biddlemore Hospital in New Zealand, looking at prevention of central line-associated bloodstream infections. So the graph up in the upper left corner there shows kind of a drop in the frequency of bloodstream infections and then a good sustainability. One thing I found interesting about this study is they actually developed a care and maintenance checklist. We have lots of checklists available, but one thing that's unique is I think we've got the insertion piece pretty well done in terms of making sure we do the right things for prepping the patient and also the provider and asepsis strategies for them. But this group, really, Seaton and others, looked at maintenance and care of the intravascular device once it's placed, and they have a checklist that they developed in the lower left side there. The other metric I found intriguing about this is they looked at the number of days between events of concern. So when they look at number of central line associated bloodstream infections, they found a pronounced increase in the number of days between those episodes, and they could provide that to the care team in the patient care units and actually encourage them to keep this sustained over a long period of time. So some good findings, I think, that are available in the literature. Slide 36, there's actually a journal called Implementation Science, and we're all, as infection preventionists, worried about good stewardship when we use antimicrobials. So this was some very nice conceptual model presented by Dr. Troutner and others that are looking at the kind of combined force between the clinicians who are prescribing antibiotics, but also we as infection preventionists encouraging them to avoid over-treatment for conditions for which there's going to create more problems, such as asymptomatic bacteriuria. Again, slide 37, not all the evidence shows you that one particular intervention is effective, and I found this interesting. This is from Journal of Hospital Infection. First author is Kasaptabal. I think I'm pronouncing that close to accurate, but some work in Thailand looking at feeding back certain specific surgical site infection rates as well as standardized infection ratios in 7 hospitals. They found that despite sharing that confidentially back to the surgeons, they actually did not see a drop in outcome indicators, including the standardized infection ratio or the rates of infection. So not what I like about this study is not all the studies that you see in the literature are always going to have a positive impact, and we can learn a lot from those that don't have successful results because that may stimulate other investigation to see why this didn't work in these particular facilities. Again, there's a fair amount of evidence that providing this data back to surgeons actually can lower the frequency of infection. So some interesting controversies that we've seen out there. Slide 38, just wanted to highlight, this is an in-press or kind of a pre-press article review by Dr. Manning and Davis looking at creating a journal club, which I think is a great idea. So if you're in a larger facility or have colleagues that you meet with on a fairly frequent basis, would encourage you to take a look at this particular review article because it gives you some ideas for actually convening a journal club, picking a study of interest that you found in the literature, and then have a group kind of discuss it. What do the findings mean, and how do we apply those findings here at your particular facility? So some good ideas to, again, help sharpen those skills that we've been talking about today. Slide 39, lastly, just wanted to give you an idea of a conceptual model using the evidence, and this is one of the approaches developed by Dr. Sanjay Saint and others that are using this to improve patient safety and quality. In particular, this is the model that originally was developed by Dr. Peter Pronovost and colleagues at Johns Hopkins University, looking at ways to improve patient safety and quality of care and using this as a conceptual model of engage to educate providers, execute the intervention, and then evaluate, was it successful? So some good ways to look at if you're going to elevate this from reviewing the literature to actually doing the study, this is a good formula or kind of a formula to use for your particular investigation. And with our last slide, just some additional resource and readings that are available for you to look at and get a little more practice or learn more about evidence-based approach. And I was also on the CHICA website earlier today, Jim, and found something called the Canadian Foundation for Healthcare Improvement. So if you're listening from Canada, there is actually a program for fellowships to which you can apply and actually learn quite a bit about it's basically executive training for research applications. So it's teaching you about methods to find this evidence and apply it to improve patient care at your facility. So for my colleagues in Canada, I would encourage you to apply for this because it looks like an excellent program, and you can get more details from CHICA.org, CHICA.org, and take a look at that and hopefully get your application in. But with that, Jim, I think we're at the end of this session. Appreciate the time and attention, and I don't know if we have time for questions or if you have any of me, but really appreciate everybody's listening in on today's session.
That was a great presentation, Russ. I appreciate the time you took to put this together and present it to us. We are at the end of our allotted time here. I've got 14:30 showing on my laptop here. If anyone does have any questions for Russ Olmsted on his presentation, or if you need more information, send those questions through to Weber Training with the information that you have with your subscription. And again, I'd like to thank Virox for sponsoring the presentation that we have today. I don't have a current slide on my deck here. I'm not sure if Paul has added upcoming presentations to the deck that's up on the website. But please stay tuned for further wonderful presentations that will be coming down the pipe here. And I thank you all for listening in today. Thank you very much, Russell.